Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Gary Steingart, otherwise known as Igor Semyonovich Steingart, whose latest book is Little Failure, a Memoir. Gary Steingart is the author of Super Sad True Love Story, Absurdistan, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. This memoir is fairly unusual in that you're pretty young to be writing a memoir. However, this is partly a memoir, the immigrant story, and the story of growing up in Russia. It's also the story of someone growing up in New York.
Queens, New York.
Being in a Jewish family that really doesn't practice the religion.
Not at all.
Why did you decide to write a memoir? When I talked to you last time about Super Sad True Love Story, you told me you were writing it, and I was scratching my head a little. What prompted you to write it and write it now?
In the previous three novels, I was almost shocked when I reread them about how much autobiographical material I had almost subconsciously thrown in there. So I thought, hey, you know, let's have a fire sale. Let's just give away everything in the store. And in a way, that can help me clear up and stuff up and move on to something different, you know, so that maybe I won't have a Russian-Jewish nebbish protagonist in the next book. In Super Sad, my last novel, one of the characters was a Korean-American, very young Korean-American woman, and I greatly enjoyed writing from her perspective. So this is sort of my gigantic, no-holds-barred, all-guns-blazing, Soviet-Jewish Ashkenazi pessimist extravaganza.
Did you keep diaries or anything over the years?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I have. We can't show it on the radio, but there's even photocopies of some of my first novels that I wrote when I was 11 years old. You know, I'm still possess enough memory as to what happened. In fact, I think I have a really good memory of what happened even when I was 5, 6 years old in Leningrad. So I wanted to be closer to that age in terms of writing the memoir. And I didn't want to be able to form too many judgments about my life as an entirety, which often happens when you're writing, you know, much later in life. I wanted the immediacy of still having these feelings be painful to me, which is they still are, obviously, in writing this.
Did you write it chronologically?
I did. Well, before I started writing about myself, I wrote about my family. I did a lot of research into my family.
How? What kind of research?
Well, I would talk to them. I looked things up. And, you know, yeah, the typical sort of Soviet Jewish family where Hitler killed a bunch of people and then Stalin took care of the rest. You know, my mother has these albums, photo albums, and they're categorized. She's a very meticulous categorizer. So you see things like Uncle Simon, family buried alive. You know, that's one chapter heading for photographs, which I don't think people in Cape Cod, for instance, have that many of those albums. You know.
Gary Steingart, what revelations were there for you in that early research, just talking to your parents about, before you even came on the scene?
I'd always wondered how my parents became the people they are. I grew up with the moniker Little Failure that my mother had called me in Russian. They were not easy people. They were loving, but they were very tough. They were very upset that I wasn't a successful lawyer and that I didn't do a lot of the things that they thought they brought me over here to do. You know, there's nothing like failure among immigrant families is considered something that's you know, very, very shameful. And I wanted to figure out how they became the people they were. And in researching just the way they grew up, my father's first memories, he was born in 38. His first memories were somebody showing up at his doorstep telling him that his father was dead, killed in the war.
And you didn't know that before.
I knew that, but just hearing him talk about it was very visceral. And then I didn't know that when he was evacuated from Leningrad as the German troops approached, the whole family hid under a train that was transporting them as the German airplane strafed the plane. Then the third memory is his best friend, this kid Leonya, dying probably of starvation at age 3 or 4. The fourth memory is his cousin jumping out of a window in the countryside where they were hiding because these rats were attacking her. Anyway, it was, you know, and learning about them, I began to understand the sadness, especially the sadness of losing his father and then being raised by a stepfather who was, in the tradition of stepfathers, incredibly cruel and violent.
Did you ever kind of hit yourself for not asking these questions earlier?
I mean, I knew some of this earlier. When I grew up, as many kids with parents who are demanding and sometimes hit you, I was very angry. I was boiling with rage. They told me some of these stories, but I was too self-involved to ask for more. I mean, when you're a teenager or younger or even a little bit older, the main subject of your life is yourself, and it's hard to figure out that there's people that gave birth to you who have their own intense stories. I started writing this when I was 38, and that's a good sort of midpoint when you can really tackle these stories.
The other element, and one reason maybe you couldn't, is because for a long time they didn't get along and they were on the verge of divorce.
Yes, the Russian word razvod.
Why did you pepper your memoir with Russian words, and was there a specific reason for using the Russian rather than the English?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I use the Russian, I always explain what it means in English. First of all, I have a wonderfully sizable audience of Russian Americans my age who, it's heartbreaking. I mean, they come to these readings and so many of them had very similar backgrounds. A lot of them are in San Francisco in the, you know, the Google sector of the economy. So all those beatings amounted to something good. They're doing well. So for them, you know, partly I wanted them to hear words like razvod and know exactly what it means, rodniki, relatives, some of the curse words they may have known growing up. But I also love, you know, when I read fiction by people from a different culture, I love reading Juno Diaz and hearing all the Spanish sort of, you know, in the background. I think it's wonderful and gives you, the reader, an idea of what something sounds like, you know. I mean, how harsh and cruel does the word razvod sound compared to our very benign divorce?
And I guess when you went back to St. Petersburg, which, of course, at that point was Leningrad, you were able to chart what you'd already written about those years?
Yeah. I mean, I started coming back in my late 20s to St. Petersburg, which I still think is a city in Florida, but apparently Leningrad isn't hip enough anymore. The focus of all these trips was figuring out who my parents were, in a way. Why am I walking down the street and why is no one smiling? Why does everyone look like they just had a really bad turkey sandwich? You know, what's wrong with people? Where does all that sadness come from and that distrust of others and the general sense of a malaise and the strict conservatism that I grew up with? So in meeting Russians of my generation, but who have also had parents of my parents' generation, I began to, I think, understand them a lot better. And some of the anger that I had growing up began to turn to sympathy and to understanding.
When you went back, did your memories jive? I mean, sometimes when I go back to my old neighbor, well, I haven't been there in a while, in North Queens, suddenly everything looks much smaller. And I'm going, is this really where I grew up? I remember going to my old house and the big foyer was the size of a table.
Well, I was lucky to grow up in a neighborhood that was pure Stalinist. It was designed by Stalin's architects in the southern part of Leningrad. It was designed to be the new center of the city, actually, the Winter Palace and all, the Palace Square. That was supposed to be just for tourists, and the main center was supposed to move down. So it hadn't gotten smaller. If anything, it looked as humongous as I'd ever recalled. There was a statue of Lenin that was the biggest statue of Lenin in Leningrad. So you can imagine how giant it was. And his arm was spread out, and we called him the Latin Lenin because he looked like he was about to rumba. You know, he had this very danceable look. And behind him was a building that we called the House of Spies because it was supposed to be a closed military object. And so these were all amazing sort of gigantic things, and I remember them so well. In America, when I came here, there was a lot of problems, and problems with assimilation, with language, with culture. And there's some things that were hard for me to remember. But in Russia, my recall was amazing, even though I left at age 5 or 6. No, I left at age 6 and got here at 7.
That Lenin statue is still there?
Of course it's still there. Russia doesn't get rid of its tyrants. I mean, I hope there's enough space that someday there'll be a statue of Putin next to it.
Much smaller, I would think.
It could be bigger, you know. Maybe they'll be holding hands in some kind of gay embrace. That would be not Putin's way, but that would be a great commentary on Putin's homophobia.
There was this median point where you and your family were in Rome, in Italy. Do you remember any of the Italian story at all now?
Well, yeah, I remember we had heard that there were a lot of communists in Italy and that they loved anything Russian, anything Soviet. So we brought tons of suitcases with little compasses that had hammers and sickles on them. And my job was to sell the hammers and sickles. I was a pretty cute kid. So there was a market called Porta Portese in the American market in Trastevere. And we laid out our blankets, and on the blankets we put out all these different compasses. And I would sit there saying, mille lire, 1,000 liras, which was, I don't know, a dollar or less than a dollar per compass. And we made out like bandits. We really got rid of the whole score, and we lived pretty well off those hammer and sickle compasses.
Okay, so you were between 6 and 7. Your parents were adults, and did they have politics, really, other than just wanting to get the hell out of Russia? And from your perspective, were you indoctrinated, or were you just a little kid who, you know, liked Lenin?
I was completely indoctrinated. The Red Army was my grow up to be a cosmonaut or a Red Army soldier. Those were my dreams, and maybe to attack America someday, you know, in a large MiG fighter. I loved Lenin so much that at age 5 I wrote a novel that was an homage to him. I wrote it for my grandmother called Lenin and His Magical Goose, in which Lenin meets a magical goose and they invade Finland together and create a socialist revolution there. And then we find out the goose is Menshevik. Lenin's Bolshevik, of course, so Lenin eats the goose. And my grandma paid for the whole thing in 100 slices of cheese, one slice of cheese per page. So I would write more and more just to get this horrible, plasticky Soviet cheese. But when we got to Rome, you know, my father sat me down. He said, look, it was all a lie. It was the Red Army, all that stuff is just nonsense. And we're going from Lenin to Reagan, you know. There's someone else you can worship. And I remember I had these two clothing pins. They were my only toys. And I would pretend that one was a Soviet Tupolev plane and the other was an American Boeing. And I would always let the Tupolev plane win because I wanted the Russians to win. And my father sat me down and said, you know, now the Boeing's going to win. And it did.
When you came over to America, by the time you were in high school, you'd become a model Republican. Do you remember the transition between being the model communist little kid and the model Republican?
You know, strong dogma is strong dogma. If you're hardwired to believe, as all Russians are, in something greater, then you'll believe in something greater if something greater is given to you. You know, I was in a taxi cab in Moscow a couple of years ago, and the taxi driver was saying, oh, God, I hate living in Russia. I am so poor. Everything sucks, you know. I want to move to America. And I said, well, you know what's really great? Canada is great these days as a growing economy. And he spit on the floor. He said, phew, I can only live in a superpower, you know. And that's a very Russian kind of mentality, that starvation, okay, not so great, but you have to live in a superpower. So, you know, the story of my life is kind of the story of the 20th century, switching from one failing superpower to another failing superpower. You know, I think every country I go to just begins to fail.
And you're moving to China soon? Is that
That's what I mean. When I go to China there, they say, hey, you know, maybe you should turn back. Not a good track record you have there.
And now we come to the part of the memoir that may have been difficult for you, because you can't write a memoir without either self-aggrandizement or kind of putting yourself down. Mm. And a lot depends upon, I guess, how open and honest you are. And that must have been pretty tough for you.
Well, it was tough. You know, I didn't want to hew, as you said, you put it correctly, you know, between self-aggrandizement and just self-effacement. The latter comes more easily to me. When your nickname is a little failure growing up, you know, you're into self-deprecation quite a bit. But I wanted to harness some of that humor and use it as a kind of, you know, the way the ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile, is the device. So here the humor is the device, but the payload is something sadder and more tragic, which is a childhood of drifting away from my parents, not understanding them, some discomforting scenes between us, which, you know, happens in all families. But I was a very sensitive, asthmatic child, and it was hard for me to move on from things. You know, I was a kid that grew up, thanks to my parents, reading Chekhov at a very early age. So my mind was more, you know, Lady with Lapdog as opposed to the A-Team or whatever shows the kids were watching.
And you didn't have a television.
We didn't have a television for a while. My parents were smart enough not to have one, and we only spoke Russian in the house. That was a good sacrifice on their part, because when the kid speaks English in the house, do the parents learn it a lot faster? But the kid forgets their mother tongue. So in my case, I remembered Russian. I still speak Russian, but my parents didn't learn English as well as they could have. But I'm very thankful for that.
How's their English now?
It's okay. It's okay, you know. But when it comes to tackling a book like this, I know that some of the nuances will obviously be lost until the Russian translation comes out.
Well, that might be good for you for a little while, at least.
Yeah. The Parent Witness Protection Program won't have to take me. Yeah.
So you grew up in Queens. You went from Kew Gardens out to Little Neck, mm-hmm. which is on the border of Queens and Nassau, right next to Great Neck, which is pretty wealthy, but Little Neck is not.
You know, I was such a provincial kid in Queens. I went to a yeshiva, and, you know, so for me, the concept of Manhattan was so far away that for a long time I thought that the three skyscrapers on Queens Boulevard, that was Manhattan. And when I actually saw the Manhattan skyline, I thought, wow, okay, that's much bigger.
And the garden apartment was in?
It's called Deepdale Gardens, which is a sort of red brick, very middle class kind of place. But for us, it was a small apartment of maybe 1,000 square feet. But for us, it felt like we had landed. We had won the lottery. It was this incredible three bedrooms. You know, Russians grow up and, you know, where an entire family could share two or three rooms. And here was three bedrooms for a family of three. We were so in love with America, and rightfully so, given where we'd come from.
I think what people on the West Coast don't understand is that if you grow up in North Queens, where both of us grew mm-hmm. up, Manhattan and New York City, or even Brooklyn, it's like Chicago or Philadelphia. It's
well
far away.
Yeah, it's really far away. Really far away. And so when I got to Stuyvesant, you know, that was the big shock for me and probably for you as well. I couldn't believe it. Everyone told me, okay, look, you're going to get mugged and probably heroined. You'll have to smoke those heroin cigarettes and shoot up the marijuana. And, you know, we were so confused about what was going to happen. But we knew it was going to be absolutely terrible because these non-Jewish people lived there and they did horrible things to you. So I showed up, you know, with my mugger's wallet, with my money in my sock and the $5 wallet just because I knew I was going to get mugged the moment I stepped there. And my mother hid behind a tree outside the school and she was going to sort of sneak behind me to make sure that I got to the subway safe and then got home safe. And almost immediately, almost overnight, I fell in love with Manhattan. I thought, my God, can you imagine that this exists, that people from everywhere exist? Not everyone is going to mug me. You know, some of these kids are not going to mug me. We're going to play a frisbee together. We're going to go to museums. Later on, we're going to learn how to drink and smoke some pot. But it was this incredible revelation for me, and I never really fell out of love with Manhattan.
Why did you go to Stuyvesant and not the local high school, which was Cardozo?
Cardozo School, yeah. Well, you know, anyone who could get into Stuyvesant, I think the idea was, hey, it's the best private, it's the best public school out there, so how do you say no to Stuyvesant? And, you know, my parents thought, okay, he goes to Stuyvesant and Harvard, Yale, or Princeton, you know, MIT at worst, you know. But when I got to Stuyvesant, good Lord, it was hard. These students were much smarter than I was. You know, it was a math and science high school, and I was great at writing little novels with names like Invasion from Outer Space, but when it came time to actually any hard science, I had no idea, or math. So I was a terrible student, and so it went from Harvey or Princeton to, well, maybe Bucknell or Lafayette or Lehigh, and then it just kept, you know, and in the end, I ended up at Oberlin. You know, in Yeshiva, I was one of the smartest kids because, well, it didn't take that much, you know. But when I got to the Stuyvesant, it was a disaster. And then when I graduated, I went to Oberlin. Things got easy again. You know, I think one of my first assignments at Oberlin was, you know, watch the movie Blade Runner and write something about it. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm back to being a great student.
The story of your life in Oberlin is also kind of a quintessential American 80s to 90s story, mm-hmm. which is kid who basically lived to a great degree under his parents' thumb, suddenly goes to this school where any and all things are possible. And within a year, the hair is down to your ass.
Yes.
You haven't shaved.
No, and showered.
Or showered. And the amount of drug taking is excessive.
It was excessive even for Oberlin. That's. I mean, I guess the inner traumas were so suppressed and severe that by the time I got to Oberlin, my moniker went from Little Failure to Scary Gary, is what the kids called me, because they couldn't believe how much a pot I could ingest. We had a 3-foot bong called Big Blue that was just, it was smoking like a chimney all the time. And you know, Oberlin is one of those schools where you could, students could also teach classes. So the guy next to me would teach a class on the Beatles for credit, you know. And so you'd get high or take some acid and you would go to his class, which consisted of just listening to Revolver over and over, and you know, it was quite a jump from calculus.
When you're writing a memoir, Gary Steingart, and the memoir consists of 4 years when you're too stoned to move, how do you remember anything?
Yeah, no, I remember one of the games we used to play was find your own left foot, you know, which sometimes took hours to find your own left foot. You know, the chapters on Oberlin are shorter than the chapters on the rest of my life because there's been so little to remember. But what happened, the most important thing that happened to me at Oberlin was that I fell in love. For the first time, I had a girlfriend. All my life, I had all pretended I was all these different things. I was a Republican for a while. I was just, you know, all these sort of performative art of kind of things. And finally, I found somebody, a woman I could talk to, and I could reveal who I was. And that's when I started writing my first novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. And the two things aren't unrelated because I had somebody who would listen to the things I said and who took me seriously because I took myself seriously in front of her. Her name was Jay-Z. And one of the reasons I remember so much from Oberlin is this was back in the day before there was email, or email was just getting started. She lived in North Carolina. I lived in New York during the summer when school was over. And we would send each other these 15, 20-page letters. Can you imagine these days a 15, 20-page email? I mean, maybe it exists, but I've yet to see one. And they were just so chock full of detail and so beautifully written. She was a wonderful writer, too. She became a doctor. But I reread these letters when preparing, and I quote some of them in this book, and I was almost in tears. They are absolutely soul-bearing and just so smart. So that's one of the ways that I can remember anything, frankly, is the fact that these letters exist.
Did you contact her for the book?
We hadn't fallen out of touch. She lived in Boston, and I saw her in Boston recently. And I asked for the letters, and you know, I thought maybe she would want to censor some of them, and she just gave me the whole bushel.
During that period, when you're looking at all of this stuff, some of which you didn't remember writing, but it was right there, what surprised you the most and what disappointed you the most?
I never think that a book should be about heroics. Was that the title of a Carver collection? No Heroics, Please? Am I making that up? I think that's the title. Anyway, there are no heroes. Nelson Mandela was a hero, but when you make someone into a hero or a heroine, you're depleting them of their humanity, because it's the nuances that make us who we are. And in writing my parents, it was very important for me to do that. But in writing about myself, it was very important to do that, to write about the manipulative, the angry, the unhappy, the sadistic part of me that was also the result of growing up the way I did, you know. And thinking about that, thinking about the way I treated people who wanted to help me, for example, was a little difficult to take. Then there was, of course, and this was partly because of the drugs, the huge gaps in memory. I mean, I kept trying to – I interviewed a lot of people, especially, you know, people from Oberlin and Stuyvesant, where I started using drugs, and there was this – monumental Ulysses-like acid trip that I thought I remembered, where I think we almost hijacked a New York subway train. But the more I tried to do my sleuthing and piece it together, the more I realized it never happened.
Then you go on to talk about your writing career a little bit. You stop pretty much at the end of that one book. You don't go on.
Yeah.
Because that book, I guess, for you at least, feels more like kind of a semi-autobiography right there.
When you write something in your 20s, you're not going to be writing about, you know, too many things other than your own love and hate of yourself. I stopped at that point for a few reasons. One was that, in a sense, I stopped being my parents' son in the way that I had grown up, which is the kind of filial obedience that is required of children in Russian culture, but also in many other cultures, Chinese, Indian, Korean. Going to Stuyvesant, there was so many similarities between all the other, you know, it's a school that's 60-70% Asian. But this was my sort of liberation, in the sense that I finally had a voice that was different from the voice I used with my parents. It was my own voice, and I could claim it, you know. Something very sad about that, too, because when you grow up an only child of two people who need you so badly, and you need them so badly, because here you are in this foreign country, and all of a sudden you become something different. You know, you become a writer, you have your own voice, people are interested in what you have to say, and what you have to say doesn't jibe with what your parents believe. You know, your parents are incredibly conservative, not Jewish religiously, but incredibly, their politics on Israel are different perhaps than your own, and that creates a feeling of sadness. You gain yourself, but you lose them. And I thought that that would be an appropriate sort of place where this memoir, which so much of it is, I mean, it's a 20th century story, but it's also the story of a family. So much of it is about my parents and myself. And that's when the relationship never was the same again, and I became my own person.
When did your politics move from Republican? I guess for a while there, when you were drugging, you had no politics because you were trying to find your legs.
No, even when the first stone that Stuyvesant, I was sort of spout off, you know, in this. Well, I still had a subscription to the National Review, so there was a lot of sort of Thatcherite discourse. There's an anecdote in the book that kind of crystallizes what it was like. I mean, in it, I volunteer for George H.W. Bush's election campaign and against Dukakis, and he wins. And I go to the victory party, and I'm all dressed up in my polyester suit, not realizing that everyone around me was going to be this sort of wealthy, Anglo-looking people. These two girls approach me, and I think, oh, my God, I'm finally going to – someone's going to fall in love with me, because they're going to see this sort of our common republicanism, and it's going to be so beautiful, these two blonde ladies. And they thought I was the waiter, and asked me for a rum and Coke. And that was sort of the beginning of realizing that maybe Republicans and myself were not exactly birds of a feather.
But have your parents changed at all?
No, I think they become more right-wing as the years go on.
Really?
As many Soviet immigrants do, yeah.
Did they watch Fox News?
Oh, yeah, they watch Fox News, and they also watch a Russian equivalent of it, which it's not even equivalent. I think it's even further to the right. They asked me to go on that show once, and I was surrounded by two people talking about driving the Arabs into the sea, and, you know, ways to liquidate them. And I was like, okay, well.
What do they think of Putin?
Putin they dislike, to their credit, because there's nothing to like. I think one has to be really, he's beyond politics when one has to hate him. He's a horrifying kleptocrat and two-faced liar. And he's clever in the sense that he realizes that anti-Semitism doesn't really fly in the international stage, so he's trying out homophobia to see if that's the... And he's getting some pushback, too, but not as much as he would with anti-Semitism. Look, you know, Russia's always, it's always a disaster. I mean, there's not... It had the worst feudalism, the worst socialism, and then the worst turbo capitalism. So whatever you have, it's not going to be good. I always talk about, there was a restaurant in St. Petersburg I went to once, and it was called 1913. And I asked the owner, I said, why 1913? And she said, well, it was the only good year in Russian history, you know, which I thought was fairly accurate. Everything Gogol wrote in Dead Souls is there. If you're an investor trying to figure out how to invest in Russia, I wouldn't read any of the, you know, Russian business magazines. I would just read Dead Souls, and that's all you ever need to know.
Gary Steingart, you finished this book, and it's come out. And have your parents tried to read the English language version?
I don't know. And I sent it to them, but we haven't discussed it.
Are you scared?
No. The book doesn't shy away from things that happened that I wish hadn't happened. But at the same time, they brought me here at great sacrifice. You know, my mother had a choice to make whether to leave her mother, her dying mother behind, and her sister who would later die as well. And if she did that, I would be conscripted into the Red Army perhaps, and God knows what would have happened to me. So she chose me over her entire family, you know, and that's in the book, and that's something that is very important to note. My father gave up language, culture, so many things that he knew, career in some ways. It was a huge move. And they did it for me. And the results were mixed, of course. But in the end of the day, when you calculate it, my God, how happy I am that they did this for me and that I'm here.
In writing a memoir, you have to deal with memory and with different people's memory, with your own memory. And you don't always have a piece of paper in front of you. How concerned were you with fact, with memory, with even fictionalizing?
Right. Since it's a memoir, obviously my goal was as truthful as one can make it. Several things I did. One is that, thankfully, again, thanks to my parents, so much of what I'd written, from little novels to book reports to this thing I wrote in Hebrew school called the Gonora, which was a satire in the Torah with chapters like Sexodus instead of Exodus, you know. All of that exists. My parents saved it. So it's very easy for me to get into the kind of mindset that I had back then as a child. The humor of it, but also the kind of underlying sadness and rage that underpinned it. Endless amounts of photographs my parents took, which gave me a good idea of how sadly my body developed in ways I wish it hadn't. And then what I did was I sat my parents down and took huge amounts of interviews. I gathered as many friends as I kept in touch with from those era and talked to them about stuff and recorded it. And finally, I took my parents back to Russia, and I go back almost every year since my 20s, but they haven't been back in about 30 years, and I took them back. And I learned a lot of things. Don't want to give too much away for the potential reader, but I learned a lot of things that were very explanatory and also very sad.
Well, that's probably the most poignant part of the book, watching your parents as they tour their home,
right.
Their old home. I mean, you know.
So much of the book is me sort of building up these ideas about them and both loving them and in some parts of the book not loving them at all, being very angry at them, but not really understanding who they are. And what I hope to accomplish in the last chapter, and I don't know if I do, but I hope I do, is it comes full circle and I start to understand how they became who they are. And the feeling is one of awe and kind of and sympathy as well, because these were not happy childhoods.
Does your mother still charge you for chicken?
This was very funny. And when I graduated from Oberlin, I was quite poor. I was working as a paralegal for a civil rights law firm. And I told my parents, look, you know, I'm coming out. I want to be a writer. And my mother was, of course, quite livid because she wanted me to go to law school. And so she took this very tough love approach that she wouldn't give me anything. So at one point I came to their house in Little Neck from the city, and my mother had these chicken Kiev cutlets, which Russians love, which is just this giant chicken cutlet stuffed with explosive butter. You know, it's basically death. Not even death on a stick, death on a bone. And she said, well, I think they were retailing for $17. She said, I'll give them to you for $20, and I'll throw in some cellophane wrap, you know. And there I was arguing with my mother, trying to get the price down to $17. And I said, you know, why? Why can't you just give me these cutlets? I don't have money, you know. And she said, because if I don't, you will not go to law school.
And you didn't anyway.
And I didn't anyway. And the sort of joke of it is that lawyers are being fired left and right now, whereas being a writer is not a real profession to begin with. So I'm okay. I remember when the first book came out, the Russian Dipton's Handbook, the reviews came in, and Mishka Kakutani of the New York Times, the most important of the reviewers, loved it. It was this incredible rave. And raves started coming in from all over, all parts of the country. But there was one really bad review, and it was from a certain newspaper called the San Francisco Chronicle. You may have heard of it. So there was this one really bad review. And that's the review that I read over and over and over again, not the good ones, you know, because that felt familiar and comfortable. That was the one that said, hey, you're a little failure still.
On your Wikipedia page, it says you're a prolific blurber.
Yeah.
What is a blurber?
Well, you know, somebody writes a book and they want you to say something nice about it. Most writers are very selective about whom they blurb. I was ecstatic that Little Failure has blurbs by Mary Carr and Zadie Smith and Carl Hyacin. I mean, God bless these people. I almost want to cry when I think about it. But they blurb very sporadically, so it was a real honor to get their blurb. To get a blurb for me is not a great honor because I blurb every single book that comes my way. I mean, my requirements are it has to have two covers, a spine, and an ISBN number, and I will blurb it. So to date, I've blurbed about 150, 160 books. There's a documentary about my blurbing on YouTube, which dissects my blurbing pattern. Basically, my blurbs are sort of like, not since blank has blank, so not since Tolstoy's Anna Karenina has there been a novel about shopping that's been so moving and funny, you know. People keep sending me stuff to blurb, but what they don't understand is that my blurb kind of devalues their book. If they want a successful book, they wouldn't ask me for this.
I remember somebody, a local writer, asking me for a blurb. I started reading the book. I couldn't get past page 3, and I promised him a blurb. And I talked to a friend of mine, Frank Robinson. I said, what do you say? He said, torn from the headlines.
That's great. No, mine are getting more and more sort of shorter. It's sort of like, so-and-so has written a book. Gary Steingart, author of...
What people don't understand, and I think that this is key to it, and why, in a way, this conversation is more serious than it sounds, is that when you see blurbs, don't always trust the fact
right.
that the author of the blurb has read the book likes the book.
Never. No. Most authors haven't read the book or liked the book. Yeah. Don't trust them. I know, I was giving a ring in Seattle yesterday, and a gentleman came up and said, you know how much money you've cost me because I always buy your blurb books and they're always awful? And I said, how much? Charge me. I'll pay you back. You know, there should be a money-back guarantee. You know.
You've been listening to an interview with Gary Steingart, whose latest book is a memoir, Little Failure. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.